just said.
He turned on the AC.
Give the guy now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All the documents for the habitat discussion are, as usual, behind tab 7. And I'll just go down the latest. There were two public hearings on the omnibus habitat amendment, one during the last New England Council meeting and one during the April Mid-Atlantic Council meeting. Also, as the status sheet says, the PDT has met, the Habitat Advisory Panel, and the committee met just 2 weeks ago to discuss and make final decisions on recommendations for the new essential fish habitat designations, as well as recommendations for HAPC designations and the prey species document and evaluation of non-fishing activities on EFH. So those are the meetings that have taken place since the council last met. And today, the action that the council needs to take is approval of final action on phase one of the essential fish habitat Amendment 2, which, as everyone knows, amends all of the FMPs under the jurisdiction of the New England Council. there are several documents 1 through 9, which everyone should be referring to inform this discussion. Document 1 behind tab 7 is the omnibus amendment timeline. If you've looked at that, you'll see that we've done quite a bit over the last 3 years to get to this point. Document 2, which compares status quo to the committee recommended EFH designations, is a helpful document for people to refer to. The HAPCs, which we'll get to later, are described in maps in Document 3. There's a packet of public comments that were received during the comment period in April. A summary of the public hearings, which are very brief, that I mentioned, which took place in Mystic and Ocean City, Maryland. Then the more recent memos from the PDT to the committee, and then the summaries of the advisory panel meeting, which took place on June 5th in the morning, which included one motion, which is in that meeting summary, as well as the it's included in the committee meeting summary, which is document number 9. And I'll also note that there was a minority report submitted from the advisory panel, which is included in your stack of documents. Leslie Ann has a presentation just to kind of orient the council to the decisions that are going to be made today. One additional document that was handed out today that was on the table is document number 12, which is the decision document. It's pretty straightforward. There are 4 decisions that are to be made today, which are informed by the committee recommendations from the last committee meeting. So once Leslie Ann is ready, I think it'd be best for her to give her presentation to get everyone oriented to the decisions to be made today.
Jim Salisbury.
Sally, did you said that there was a handout that came just now, today?
No, well, it was on the table for everyone this morning.
This morning,
in the supplemental materials.
Okay. And then there was something that was handed out on my place, but I don't know if everybody got it. Is this something that's designation of habitat areas of particular concern in the Great South Channel? Is that something that's a document that we all get, or?
That was not something that was just put on the table during the lunch break. The document that I was referring to that everyone should have was handed out in the packet this morning. It's document number 12. It's labeled Essential Fish Habitat Omnibus Amendment Phase 1 Decision Document.
Thank you.
L.A., whenever you're ready. Jimmy, all set?
Yes, thank you.
L.A.?
Thanks. Okay. Just to remind you what the goals are of Phase 1, we are seeking to redefine, refine, or update the identification and description of all EFH for those species of finfish and mollusks managed by the Council, including the consideration of habitat areas of particular concern. We're also identifying, reviewing, and updating the major non-fishing activities that may adversely affect EFH of those species managed by the Council. And we're also reviewing and updating prey species information for each species in our fishery management unit. Those are the goals of Phase 1. And I keep doing this to you, but these are the 27 species that the New England Fishery Council manages. Therefore, these are the 27 species for which we're redesignating essential fish habitat and the other issues. There's this asterisk next to monkfish. As you know, we manage monkfish jointly with the Mid-Atlantic Council. I've been to the Mid-Atlantic Council, I think, 5 times in the last year and a half and have briefed them each time on this action. Just a couple of things of note. The EFH Omnibus Amendment has consistently been on the Council's priority list. The DSEIS was developed using a very public process, and it included a formal solicitation for HAPC proposals. In parentheses, you see numbers. Those are the numbers of meetings that we've had in order to get to this point. We've had 13 committee meetings, 7 advisory panel meetings, 13 PDT meetings. We had 6 meetings of our EFH peer review workshop, working group. We have had 1 non-fishing impacts workshop, and I'm sorry, we briefed the Mid-Atlantic Council 4 times. Just to remind you, the Council unanimously approved the committee EFH preferred alternative recommendations and included all of the committee HAPC alternatives in the document for public comment. Just as an overview, the document, again, is quite large. It's about 1,400 pages in the main document and about 1,000 pages in the appendices. But if we're amending 7 FMPs, then that's only about 300 pages per FMP, which meets the NEPA guidelines from CEQ. So sections 1 through 4 are listed here. They're of no surprise to any of you. Section 5 is we're calling additional EFH components. That's where our prey species and non-fishing impacts. These are evaluation sections, so there's no alternatives associated with them. Section 6 is our affected environment section, and our valued ecosystem components are biological and physical, economic, and social environments. Section 7 is the environmental consequences section, which evaluates the impacts of EFH alternatives and HAPC alternatives in attempts to address cumulative effects. Section 8 is our data and research needs. Section 9 is our Magnuson-Stevens consistency section. Other applicable law take up a lot of space. And Section 15 are all the appendices. I believe it's A through H. The process by which we got here is taken a very direct path, of course. We started with the EFH Regional Steering Committee, which has members on it from the New England Council staff, Mid-Atlantic Council staff, ASMFC, the Science Center, and the Regional Office. And we approached the NRCC in May 2004 with an idea of developing a peer review process for how to designate EFH. From that, they approved it and developed a working group. The working group took about 9 months to look at all the EFH designation methodologies and comment on them and recommend them to a peer review group, which met in June of 2005. And from that peer review work group, we got short and long-term recommendations. The long-term recommendations were fed into the Science Center's process. They're looking at, have been looking for the last couple of years at how to look at EFH designations in the long term. But in the short term, those recommendations went to the council, and the plan development team worked to develop a set of designations, which is housed under Alternative 3, which meet those peer review recommendations. The council approved all of the DSCIS alternatives for EFH designations in March. We've been out to public comment, and here we are today in June making final decisions on those. There are several designation alternatives in the document. Just to remind you, Alternative 1 is the no-action alternative, which means that the status quo EFH designations will remain in place. Alternative 2 is an abundance-only alternative. It essentially uses the same method as Alternative 1, but includes updated source data, different years of data for various reasons, a modification of the data treatment, and an inclusion of state data, which is a first for us. To not just rely on Elmer information, but also to include state fishery data. Alternative 3 is the abundance plus habitat considerations alternative. This is the alternative that was born out of the peer review process. It is Alternative 2 plus a consideration of habitat variables, which are temperature, depth, and sediment, in addition to the off-shelf data. I need to also tell you that the prey species descriptions are also included in the EFH text descriptions as well, so we've actually built them into it. And Alternative 3 also develops a mapping component, because we're required to map EFH, that feeds directly off of the EFH text descriptions. So no longer do you have a map that is just looking at survey data, but your text description describes other variables. We now have a mapping component that takes into account most, if not all, of the habitat variables described in the text description. Alternative 4 is a species range alternative. It looks at the 100% observed range of a species or life stage, both inshore, shelf, and off-shelf areas. Obviously, we use different data for different realms, spatial realms. We use state fisheries data and Elmer data for the inshore areas. We use NIMS trawl survey for the shelf areas. And we use mostly literature, but some survey in the off-shelf areas. We do have an alternative 5 and 6 in the document for a few species. There are just places where the committee felt that Alternative 3 or Alternative 2 needed to be slightly tweaked in its method, and they created a few alternatives really only for scallops, offshore hake, and winter flounder. And they're always a derivation of one of the other alternatives. And there's an Alternative 6 for winter flounder, which is another slight derivation. Alternative 3 is obviously where the PDT and the council have spent most of their time. Alternative 3, as I said, was developed in response to a peer review process. It is a GIS-based EFH designation methodology that combines the primary elements of Alternative 2 with habitat features that are associated with high catch rates of benthic juveniles in adult life stages. The spatial extent of EFH was divided into four general geographic realms. We have the inshore realm, the shelf realm, the off-shelf realm, and we also have a seamount realm, largely because of the different data sets, as I said. The reason why I'm spending so much time on Alternative 3 is because it makes up the bulk of the committee's recommendations to the council. This is the preferred juvenile winter flounder EFH alternative. I just happened to pick winter flounder as an example. But you can tell if you look closely, the constraints spatially are not do not use 10-minute squares as the sole constraint. We have other habitat variables. And basically what we did is we took the cumulative catch rate over time, the NIMS trawl survey. We evaluated both spring and fall bottom depth separately. So essentially what you do is you are able to coordinate the information that you get off of the trawl survey, not just for catch, but also for the habitat variables therein. And you're able to look at frequency distributions and pick out the correct depth ranges and temperature ranges seasonally and feed them into the model. Then you take into account sediment composition if a species in a life stage has an affinity to a particular type of sediment. Then what you do is, because you don't want habitat to drive, you don't want the habitat variables, the abiotic variables, to drive your model. You have to sort of restrict how far out you're just basing, EFH just on habitat variables and not on catch. So what we do is we, for instance, at a 50% cumulative catch rate, our habitat model only extends out to the 75% catch rate. It has a sort of a boundary that we've put on it so that you're not finding something, you know, where you've never seen a species, but you're sort of bounding it by the next highest catch rate. And then we add our inshore state data. We have a frequency of occurrence data approach because all the states' data are captured in different ways, and we can't intercalibrate their methods, and we didn't even attempt to. That would take probably a long time if it was even feasible. So we looked at essentially if a life stage of a species occurred more than a certain period of time in each spatial unit, it was included. And then we added an off-shelf depth range. It just happens to be that the map I'm showing you here for winter flounder, it doesn't have an off-shelf designation because just the nature of the beast here. But so you're able to sort of look at the difference between what is status quo EFH, which is the one on the left, and what is the preferred alternative EFH or the recommended alternative for winter flounder on the right. And you can see you have a much more highly refined EFH designation than you did prior. And you also have a much more informed EFH designation because you're not just looking at catch data, you're looking at state data and all the abiotic habitat variables as well. With respect to HAPCs, the EFH final rule tells you that FMPs should identify specific habitat types or areas within EFH as HAPC based on one or more of the following considerations. There's two important things to take away from that sentence. One is that HAPCs have to be EFH. HAPC is a subset of EFH. So whatever area you want to designate as HAPC must be designated as EFH first. And also that the EFH final rule only prescribes to you the requirement that you meet one of the four criteria that are outlined in the final rule. The council, in addition to those criteria that are laid out in the regulations, added some other preferences for the types of proposals that we received and that we forwarded. One was that you will improve the fisheries management in the EEZ. You wanted to see HAPCs that include EFH designations for more than one council-managed species. You wanted to see alternatives that included juvenile cod EFH or that were designed specifically for juvenile cod EFH. And you wanted to see proposals that met more than one of the final rule criteria. This was an extremely public process. We issued a formal request for proposals that lasted 90 days. We received nine full proposals. There was an extensive proposal form that they had to follow when they submitted one, and they had to address the different criteria. The PDT and the AP looked at these proposals. We were actually able at that time to ask the proposers questions at that meeting about their proposal. That meeting was well attended. And then the PDT evaluated those proposals and developed advice to the committee. The AP did the same. The committee reviewed those proposals and decided which ones to recommend to you be converted from public proposals into management alternatives. And then the PDT went and refined those proposals based on the committee's direction. And then the committee recommended those alternatives to you, and you included a range of them in the DSEIS in November. It says January because you added one after you approved the range before we went out to public comment. There are nine distinct alternatives with many sub-alternatives. Alternative one is the status quo HAPCs. This is the no action. These are the existing HAPCs that we have on the books right now. We have an Atlantic salmon HAPC on the left that designates certain rivers in Maine as HAPC for Atlantic salmon. And we also have the juvenile cod HAPC on Georgia's Bank inside closed area 2. These maps are all included in document, a very short document where they just have the maps. Document 3 in your packet here is just these HAPC maps, so you can look at them in more depth. But essentially what each map does, it shows you where the groundfish closed areas are, where the habitat closed areas are, which are hatched, and where the HAPC alternatives are, which are blue. Well, black in your black and white copied document. Back up here. The committee recommended these two alternatives. In the parentheses where it says recommended, these are committee recommended alternatives. HAPC alternative 2 is a CMOM proposal. There were two options in the document, 2A, which included only those CMOMs that had documented presence of red crab on them, and option B, which was included Physalia seamount by analogy because it is the same morphology. It's essentially the same shape. It's very similar in depth, and we, even though Physalia has never been explored, it would likely have red crab if it was explored, so we put that out to public comment as well. But what the committee is recommending here is they are recommending option A, which is the two seamounts, bear and retriever, where we have evidence, but they're recommending it as it bounded by the deep-sea red crab alternative. The deep-sea red crab alternative 3A in the document is actually a sort of irregularly shaped polygon that is defined by depth. So it's essentially what they're recommending here is these areas, but the HAPC won't be a box. It'll be a depth polygon, which is within those boxes. HAPC alternative 3 are deep sea canyons. There are a number of individual alternatives under this. The committee has recommended alternative A, E, F, G, H, J, K, L, M, N, and O. And what that is it's all of the canyon alternatives. They've recommended all of the canyon alternatives, but what they've done with, for instance, Lydonia, Oceanographer, and Gilbert is they've recommended the box that contains all three, which is alternative N. This big box is alternative N. The alternatives inside the box are B, C, and D. So they're not recommending B, C, and D individually. They're recommending the bigger box around it, which is N. And likewise, for Toms and Hendrickson and Middle Toms, there is an HAPC alternative for that, for these two, Hendrickson and Toms, in the document. They're not recommending the individual alternatives. They're recommending the larger box. The larger box is O, and the individual ones within there are I forget what number letters there, but they're not recommending the individual ones. It's hard to keep this all straight. So essentially their alternatives are every single canyon that was proposed, but where there were larger boxes that contained or crossed different canyons, they recommended those instead of the individual ones. Alternative 4 is the Cache's Ledge area alternative. When you look at this slide, you see there's a number of different lines. The triangular shaped black outline is the groundfish closure. The blue box is the HAPC alternative that went out to public comment. And the hatched box on the inside is the current habitat closed area. So what the committee is recommending to you is instead of the big blue box as HAPC, the smaller habitat closed area that's inside of it as HAPC. So they're going on the notion that they sent out a larger area for public comment, and they're refining their recommendation to be the smaller area inside of it. The alternative 5 is the Georges Bank Northern Edge area alternative. It's the entire blue box here. It obviously contains the current HAPC, which is inside closed area 2, but this alternative was not recommended by the Habitat Committee for approval. Alternative 6 is the Jeffries Ledge Stellwagen Bank alternative. There were three alternatives put out to public comment, or three options out to the public. And the initial option, the maps are slightly mislabeled, but the initial option is just to make the current habitat closed area an HAPC. Option B is to make the entire western Gulf of Maine groundfish closure and this bump out to the west as HAPC. And this actually bump out should look somewhat familiar to you because it was an alternative for a habitat closed area in Amendment 13 a few years ago. And option C was the entire western Gulf of Maine groundfish closed area with the addition of the entire boundary of Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary. The committee recommended option A, which is the habitat closed area as an HAPC. Alternative 7 is an inshore cod habitat HAPC, and the two alternatives that went out to public comment was to designate everything from 0 to 10 meters as HAPC for cod, or everything from 0 to 20 meters. And these in the left, these are just blow-ups to show you the differences that you would sort of experience between a 10-meter HAPC and a 20-meter HAPC. The committee recommended the 0 to 20-meter area to be HAPC for cod. The alternative 8 is the Great South Channel HAPC. It was this entire blue box that, if you recall, in January you decided to send out to public comment because the PDT was unable to refine it other than to make two different alternatives, one to the west of the 50-meter contour and one to the east, but you opted to send out the whole block to public comment. As you can see, it overlaps Closed Area 1, parts of Nantucket Lightship, and it was specifically drawn to include the gap between the Stellwagen Bank area and the western Gulf of Maine area that wouldn't have been included in another HAPC alternative. And they did not recommend this alternative for approval. Alternative 9 is in the document. It includes the removal of both the status quo Cod HAPC on Georges Bank and the status quo Atlantic Salmon HAPC in Maine. This alternative was not recommended by the committee. If you want to see a map of it, go back and look at Alternative 1 because it's essentially removing what is the status quo. The document also includes a description of the prey species, which was largely derived from the newly revised EFH source documents, the evaluation of the food habits database that the center has. And we also met our requirement to show maps of quote-unquote major prey species. And the document both includes a textual essay format description of prey species and also a tabular presentation. And it's actually really interesting because if we look at the data really closely, we're able to not only break it down by life stage, but we're also able in some cases or in many cases to break it down by different parts of that life stage. As you all know, young of the year fish in some species feed on different things than older juveniles. And the life stage threshold is mean length at maturity. So especially for juveniles, it can include a very large range of sizes. So we were able to break down what they eat by their different sizes of their different life stages. The document also contains a non-fishing impact section. It was born out of a workshop that we held in January 2005, largely supported by the regional office. It includes an evaluation of the potential effects of and best management practices to minimize, mitigate, or avoid those impacts. And it forms the basis for the required section for conservation enhancement recommendations. Now, it includes many topics. These are just the chapter headings, so there's a lot of topics underneath them. But it covers everything from coastal development to energy to nuisance species. It's quite extensive. And the agency, I believe, is going to put it out as a tech memo or something of that effect soon. But it looks at all different kinds of, you know, potential non-fishing impact effects on EFH, and they range, as you can imagine, from all different types of things, from pier projects to dumping to mining to wind energy to pretty much everything. And, of course, the challenge for us as a council in some respects is to get a handle on potentially what are the cumulative effects of these impacts and how does that affect EFH. And that is, as you can imagine, you know, no small task. I have several PhDs topics waiting for me if I wanted to do that. But that's sort of we don't really have a good handle on how those cumulatively or on top of each other impact EFH, but we do have a pretty good handle on how they individually impact EFH and how specifically you could modify those types of applications to have less of an impact, if any, on EFH. The council went out to public comment with this DSCIS on April 6th. The comment period closed on May 21st. We received 12 comment letters. They are included in your packet here. They are documents 4 and 5. With total transparency, they're one of the letters. We got 5,437 of the same letter. So just wanted to point out that that organization sent us, or their members or their interested parties sent us 5,437 of the same ones, and that came from Oceana. There are also 130 form postcards that came from the same organization with different topics on them. So while I say 12 comment letters, there were thousands of them if you really add them all up. We received most of the comments on the HAPC designations, which is not a big surprise. Although we did receive a comment from the Atlantic Salmon Commission on the designation of Atlantic Salmon EFH. They recommended an alternative, which is the one that the committee ended up recommending to you. And those comments that we received were considered at both the PDT level when we were making our review of the comments and recommendations at the AP meeting and at the committee and the committee meeting. So they were, we had each group had them and looked at them when they were making their recommendations. And that's all I have for you right now.
I have four motions from the committee and can start with those if you like, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, go ahead.
The first motion, committee motion, is to approve the EFH designations for all species under management by the New England Fishery Management Council, as recommended by the Habitat MPA Ecosystems Committee, including all technical corrections outlined by the Habitat PDT.
That was a committee motion. That's in the decision document. Is that right?
Yep. I just read the first motion in the decision document.
Any comments, questions? None? Pat?
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have just one small thing. With respect to the winter flounder eggs, it's our feeling that the designation, which changes the status quo from depths of 5 meters out to 20 meters, isn't particularly well supported. And so we would suggest either going back to 10 meters, which I think could potentially be supported, or leaving it at status quo, the 5 meters. And I wondered if there was any committee discussion on that.
There was extensive discussion on this issue at the last meeting and at a previous meeting. The committee considered the data that was available originally and then subsequently discussed some studies that had been done in Long Island Sound and elsewhere. I don't remember exactly where, if it was New York Harbor or somewhere else, but that showed that winter flounder eggs were actually found at greater depths than 5 meters. And I would ask if there were others on the committee who discussed this in detail and who had we had a lot of back and forth on this to add to that. But there was a discussion about subsequent information that was available that said, yes, in fact, that the winter flounder eggs are found at depths greater than 5 meters and certainly up to 20.
Anyone on the committee want to weigh in? Dave Simpson.
Yeah, just as Sally said, we talked about this quite a bit, and then some of the PDT staff looked for additional data. The Army Corps of Engineers did some work in the New York Harbor area and found that eggs to almost 20 meters, 18 meters or something, very close to 20 meters. Eggs are notoriously hard to sample, so I think if you find them anywhere, it's evidence that it's strong evidence, because finding more than a couple is very difficult. And as I recall, some of the samples were sorted out by depth, and some of the greater densities actually were in depths much greater than 5 meters toward 20 meters. So I felt it was important to include that full depth range to identify EFH for eggs and adults as well.
John Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the Dave's discussion really highlighted gave the overview of what our discussion was. And I guess to the services point, I looked at the memo or a series of emails that they had sent out afterwards dealing with the 20-meter issue. And I think it was summed up, and Pat can correct me if I misinterpreted it, that I think the services feeling is that that if it's at 20 meters or so, that it's probably been swept there by currents and therefore not as legitimate spawning areas. And I suppose if that's the case, that they feel strongly about something like that, it, you know, we certainly could entertain the motion to go to 10 meters, which I think is at least reasonable also.
Anyone else on the committee? Jim Salisbury.
There was additional comment that using the spawning areas for adults was a reasonable proxy for the area where where the eggs and larvae would be, so that it just seemed illogical to think that you had large areas spawning in 20 fathoms, but you had no egg and larvae there. So we had a discussion that would use the spawning area as a proxy, and then that equated fairly much with the 20 fathom area, so 20 meter area, sorry.
L.A.
This is an important discussion because, and I'm sure that Pat can probably explain this maybe a little better than I can, but winter flounder egg EFH is used often in negotiations with the agency and their EFH assessments with federal permit applicants on their non-fishing impact projects. And from what I understand in this area in the New York Harbor, Long Island Sound, and south of there, the 5-meter EFH has somewhat precluded, or that's been one of their major tools for not allowing deeper dredging of channels in some of these areas, because you take the 5-meter bottom and all of a sudden make it 20-meter bottom, and then you're losing your EFH habitat for your EFH for winter flounder eggs. So this sort of stems from the consultations that go on within the agency with permit applicants on this type of issue. So that's, I think, one of the concerns that was raised. The original designation was based off of work done by Joe Pereira from the Science Center and in 1999. And since then, the Army Corps has collected data on small epibenthic sleds that has found eggs to occur to a depth of 20 meters. And there are other data sources from, you know, power stations, nuclear power stations, that have shown eggs at 12.5 meters. So while we do have evidence that they go deeper, we still need to be sensitive in some respects to the consultation issues that arises from this depth change and the designation.
Yeah, I just wanted to just add to something on those comments. And we've tried really hard in this phase one to make all of the new EFH designations based on data, and where data is lacking or sparse, the observations of individuals on the committee and the advisory panels who have a familiarity with an area or a particular species. My concern is that I don't think that those are arguments to change the depth range for a particular species life stage. I think those kinds of decisions should not be coloring whether we're determining if EFH for a particular species is in a particular place. We should be relying on data for that, not whether it's useful or not for a consultation, as much as I think it's very important, as I've said on many occasions, you know, we need to be using the EFH designations to their maximum effect in consultation, so it's clear what the impacts, the non-fishing impacts are on EFH, but not... We shouldn't be designating EFH in order to be able to do that.
Anyone else? Okay, go to the audience. Maggie.
Thank you. Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. I have a similar question about the designation for white hake. The status quo definition for adults has the EFH to 325 meters, and the preferred alternative takes that to 2,250 meters, and I was just looking for the documentation that supports that. This, what I can find so far says that it's based on substrate type, depths, temperature, and high catch rates of adults in the trawl surveys, which, to my knowledge, don't go anywhere near that depth. So I'm just looking for some more documentation on how White Hake went from 325 to 2,250 meters.
Anybody? LA?
As I said earlier, the off-shelf designations are based on catch data where we have them, but also on literature. So that's a literature observation.
Anyone else? Maggie?
So that that literature then, that's basically somebody saw that fish at that depth at some point and wrote a paper about it. Is that what you're saying?
Pretty much. That's what all the off-shelf ones are.
Well, who would be down there looking at that? I mean, I just don't understand who goes down to that depth and finds that. I mean, if it's, I don't understand how you can go to that kind of a huge change.
Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smallwoods, Fishery Survival Fund. I have two questions before I'd like to comment on this particular motion, technical questions. My first, my understanding of EFH is that we have maps by 10-minute squares, but the actual EFH designation is the textual description that's within that 10-minute square.
Are you asking me?
I believe so.
The answer is yes.
So my question then would be, for any particular 10-minute square, do we know what percentage of that, for example, if it's yellowtail flounder, do we know, I could wait. Just to take one particular species like yellowtail flounder, for any particular 10-minute square on the map identified as EFH for that flounder, do we know what percentage of that square is actual EFH for yellowtail flounder?
Our analysis is not done on a 10-minute square by 10-minute square basis. So the map is just a representation of the text description. So with respect to the map, the only place that's EFH within that box, or within that, not even a box, because we have depth that's included, is whatever the text description describes.
So my question then is, for the map depiction, for any particular 10-minute square or for any particular geographic area, do we know what percentage meets the EFH textual description?
I just answered that question.
I haven't heard an answer yet. To me, for any particular 10-minute square, I do not know what percentage meets the textual description. So there could be vast areas of a particular 10-minute square that do not meet the EFH text description.
Is EFH going to be designated in latitude and longitudes, or is it, how do you describe EFH? Is it by blocks, or?
It's by what you see in the document. It's a text description associated with a map representation, and I don't think the regulations are written any different, but I could be wrong.
Where the rubber will meet the road when you're defining 0 to 20 meters is when you develop measures to protect it, then you've got to make sure they're enforceable and define it by latitude and longitude and not a qualitative description. It has to be quantified in latitude and longitude. And I think what Ron is talking about, there's going to be a disconnect between, you know, the next phase. If you don't have exact areas but descriptive areas, but you don't have it bound with latitude and longitude on lines, it's difficult to go to the next step, I think.
Well, it's not designated by latitude and longitude now. So, and what you have under the alternatives in the document is a refinement of that approach. So, a significant refinement is with respect to alternative three. So, it takes away the spatial element of a 10-minute square for the most part. But you don't, and Pat, correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't, there's no other description in the regulation other than what's in the text description with the associated map reference. It's not designated by a latitude and longitude. It's a different way of thinking about it.
The point I'd like to make is that if you start defining anything in phase two for management purposes, you have no way to ascertain, other than the textual description, whether it's EFH or not. And most of these 10-minute squares, if you choose a particular species or combination of species, contain large areas that are not EFH for those species, that are not defined by the textual description. So when you move into your management process, you may find a lot of your EFH squares that are contained within your proposed management areas are not EFH. So in the scientific process, which is supposed to be phase one, you need to be defining very specifically what's EFH. Unfortunately, I mean, that they did the best they could with the data on hand in making an attempt, and it's a good attempt, but it has tremendous limitations, and I think you need to be fully aware of that. I had seen that a long time ago. That's why I had proposed an option where everything was EFH, but that didn't go. My second question is on red crab, just as an example. It's similar to Maggie's in that the EFH designation is based on 100% of the observed sightings of red crab, the way I understand it, both from literature and maybe surveys. Is that correct? There was a 1976 red crab survey, and there are vast areas within the designated EFH that no red crab were caught. And just to be aware, for example, Veatch's Canyon in 1974, we had an extensive four-vessel survey of the canyon using four different survey technologies. And that bottom was well described scientifically. And it's primarily meets the absence requirement, but that's not depicted. We still have EFH designations because of occasional sightings. You need to be concerned about that from a scientific standpoint. I'm not even, you know, talking about the problems that's going to raise in phase two. So being aware of those shortfalls, I think you have at this stage with weaknesses, with problems on each species, a good first-shot attempt with this motion. But somewhere along the line, when you start looking at it, you have to be aware it's the best science, but it has tremendous problems. I just hope the council remembers that. Thank you.
Dr. Stevenson?
David Stevenson from the Habitat Conservation Division at NIMS, the regional office. I'm a PDT member, too, so I've been heavily involved in this process. I just wanted to try and clarify the first question that Ron asked. The maps, as Leslie Ann said, the maps and the text descriptions of VFH very much go together. They go much together much better now than they did 10 years ago when the original designations were made. All the maps are geospatially referenced. They're all done in GIS context format, so that any map showing EFH for any species and life stage, with a GIS software, you can go to that map and know exactly what locations are or are not EFH. And the map directs you to a location where the text description applies, so that if the first thing you do is look at the map, if you're in EFH for a particular species and life stage, then you look at the text description to see if it applies. And in a few cases, it may not. It should for depth, because as Leslie Ann said, the maps for the alternative three maps are based on depth. But there isn't, in my mind, and I think PDT's mind, the committee's mind, there isn't any confusion over the maps and the text descriptions. And when it comes to making management decisions, you would simply overlay an area that's being proposed for management measures on a map of EFH, and you'd be able to tell, if you're doing this in a GIS format, you'd be able to tell immediately whether or not you're in EFH or not. And you still have to look at your text description to see if those conditions apply, but it shouldn't be a problem.
Thank you. Anyone else in the audience? Back to the council. You're on the council. Okay. All those in favor, Phil Rule.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand the way the process works, but I do share some concern on, you know, going to this GIS. I'm not sure it's really, it's to this decision, but when we go down the road a little further, I'm very concerned that, first of all, I can't believe I didn't bring enough paperwork to this meeting, but apparently I didn't, because when you go into the boxes that are in the HAPC thing, we had this discussion not too long ago, and I kind of remember your comments, a shame on us for voting on something when we have no coordinates to back it up, and I don't see coordinates in these positions. That pertains to this one, but I mean, there's no way you go through the coordinates, but I do share Paul's concern, everybody else's concern, that the next step kind of requires that. You might be able to use that procedure vendors, I mean, just lined out, but going a little further up, we have in front of us, you know, decisions we're going to make, and I just really don't, I'm not very comfortable making the same mistake we made once before.
Pat?
Just want to go back a little bit to that, to our first discussion. So given the discussion on the winter flounder depth issue, can I assume then that there is some additional information that could be included to bolster the expanding it out to the 20 meters? Or at the very least, there was discussion at the committee meeting that would be helpful in providing additional justification for that. All right, thanks.
Anyone else on the council? John Nelson.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Having been there for the first go-around on EFH, and I can't believe it's 10 years. Feels like maybe only six. But again, I probably look like the 10 years at least, though. But at that time we designated EFH based on the information that we had. This go around we had more information, and it became more refined. And I think if you compare what was done last time to this time, there's, in most cases, there's been a shrinkage, although there's certainly in some areas there's been an enlargement. In all of them, they've been the text description is what we were using. There never was anything for lat longs. There's nothing for that in the original EFH, and there's nothing being proposed in this one. I wondered if, when we were talking about lat longs, that we were starting to confuse HAPCs with the EFH designation. And I think it's legit for HAPCs to start having lat long so that you have, you know where they are, and you know if you indeed have done anything as a management measure in those areas, that people will be able to identify them as such. But I don't think that pertains to EFH designation at all. So I just, that is my interpretation. Lat longs are probably very appropriate to deal with the HAPCs, but not with EFH.
Thanks. Anyone else? Okay, back to the motion on the board. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Opposed. One in opposition. Any abstentions? Two abstentions. The motion carries 14-1 with two abstentions. Sally?
The second motion from the committee is on page 5 of the decision document, and that motion is rather lengthy. It's related to HAPC designations. And it is to approve the designation as a habitat area of particular concern, the following areas as described in the DSEIS and as modified by the Habitat MPA Ecosystem Committee recommendations. And I'll spare you listing them all out. Everyone has them in front of them, the various alternatives that the committee is recommending to be included as HAPC designations.
Okay, it's on the board. It's also in the decision document in front of you. Committee motion, any discussion? Dr. Pierce.
Yes, I'll move to amend the motion, and then if I may, Mr. Chairman, after I make the motion to amend and I get a second, I'd like to address the suggested change. I would move to amend the motion by substituting for alternative 6A, alternative 6C, modified to encompass the entire Stellwagen Bank Marine Sanctuary and the current Western Gulf of Maine habitat closed area.
Okay, motion has been made to substitute alternative 6A with alternative 6C. Is there a second? Seconded by April. Dave, you wanted to...
Yes, if I may. I wasn't at the Habitat Committee meeting, therefore I wasn't privy to all the discussions that occurred at that meeting relative to why the Stellwagen Bank Sanctuary was not included, except for the overlap with the Western Gulf of Maine closure area. However, it's clear to me that, and it should be clear to everybody else, that Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary has unique status. Frankly, when I look at the criteria regarding HAPC, I see that at least two of the criteria are met. That's the importance of historical or ecological function and sensitivity to anthropogenic stress. The sanctuary merits being designated as an HAPC. I understand the hesitancy, perhaps, of some people to want to go in that direction because of a fear that by having it as an HAPC, it will automatically lead to wholesale restrictions on mobile gear fishing within the sanctuary. But that's phase two, and frankly, those sorts of restrictions within the sanctuary are not the intent of the sanctuary. I know that because I've talked to the sanctuary staff. We've heard presentations by the sanctuary in the past. I'm a member of the Sanctuary Advisory Council, a member of the Zoning Working Group, and a number of other working groups. And I know that, yes, indeed, there likely will eventually be some suggestion by the sanctuary to have some restrictions on mobile gear within some portions of the sanctuary, maybe use of modified mobile gear in some portions of the sanctuary. But I suspect a good portion of the sanctuary would be left as is. We all know that the sanctuary is an extremely important commercial fishing ground as well as a recreational fishing area. Yes, some people will say that they can't get rid of that fear that eventually those sorts of restrictions would be in place, and they'll say that promises were made when the sanctuary was established that commercial fishing, recreational fishing would be, you know, off limits. It's for other reasons. Well, I think we've learned a lot over the last 10 years or so, certainly the last 5 years, where we've developed a greater awareness of the impact of, you know, mobile gear on some habitats, some bottom habitats, certainly the hard bottom. It's a new day, and promises, yes, indeed, are meant to be kept, but things have evolved. Our knowledge has evolved over the last 5 to 10 years. So I believe there's a very legitimate need for us to have that designation and then to work very cooperatively with the sanctuary, perhaps hand in glove, I would hope so, work cooperatively with them to better identify what needs to be done in the sanctuary with regard to protection of important habitat for ground fish and for other species. I suspect that if this council was to not include the sanctuary as an HAPC, then that would send a clear message to the sanctuary managers, maybe to the sanctuary program nationwide, that this council doesn't take the sanctuary's concerns serious. I think the sanctuary has already commented that, indeed, they would like this area, the whole sanctuary, designated as HAPC. With regard to the other part of my motion, the part that refers to the current Western Gulf Marine Habitat closed area, again, it's a motion to modify 6C because it does not include, this motion does not include the entire Western Gulf of Maine closed area. It is the existing habitat closed area, which is, frankly, I believe, the area defined in the original motion itself. With all that said, Mr. Chairman, that's my motion to amend, to do certainly a lot more than I think we need to do. We need to do a lot more for the sanctuary, and this would accomplish that.
Any other comments, questions, counsel? Dave Cathel.
Yes, I got a lot to say. As the maker of the original motion at the committee level, I think I would urge you to vote this measure down and to vote for the committee's original motion. As David stated, there's been a lot of pressure put on a lot of people by the Marine Sanctuary people after the committee vote, basically to threaten to take over fisheries management in the sanctuary if we don't vote for this. I personally think that is an inappropriate statement, and I'll put it on the record as such. But my concerns are actually more to the science involved. This was supposed to be based on the science, and people have responded with their comments, by and large, based on the science. And we were going to deal with management later, and I'd like to stick to that process. And as part of that, I'll read you a couple of brief quotes from the Western Gulf of Maine Closure Area 2007 Symposium. I received this in the mail on Friday. And I'll try and be brief. The Western Gulf of Maine closed area includes many substrate types. The URI research has shown that sand habitats are in less need of protection relative to gravel. Based on that work, full recovery may have occurred on sand and mud substrates. Recovery might be slow but ongoing on rock ledge and gravel cobble substrates. The gravel cobble and rock ledge substrates are limited in availability and are certainly vulnerable to the effects of mobile gear fishing, but are not now at risk due to the existing closure. Such limited hard substrate habitats require continued protection. The motion made by the committee covered the complex bottom, and that's the area that is rare and unique, and under the definition of an HAPC, that should be what we should be concerned with. Most of the area that's left out of the sanctuary and left out of the Jeffries closed area is sand and mud substrate. I read you one more quote, and this is from the summary and conclusions of the same document. The impacts of bottom-tending fishing gear on benthic habitat depends largely on bottom type and gear being used. Stable habitats characterized by complex flora and fauna are at greatest risk of being impacted by fishing gear. These habitats include gravel and rocky substrates. Unstable habitats, such as sand and mud, are at the lowest risk of long-term impacts. Some researchers suggest that full recovery within the Western Gulf of Maine closed area has occurred in sand and mud habitats, and that these habitats may be in less need of protection. So in short, I think in order for a habitat area of any particular concern to have any merit from a scientific point of view, it has to include the area that is most at risk. That's what the motion from the committee did. The vast majority of the remainder of both the Western Gulf of Maine closed area and the Stowaganoek Bank Marine Sanctuary is sand and gravel bottom and a lot of mud, And the few areas in it that are complex bottom are currently protected by measures we already have in place, which is the 12-inch rockhopper limit. You can't get into complex bottom with a 12-inch rockhopper. It's not going to happen. So, in short, I don't see any need for this. And in fact, I would say we substantially weaken our legal position relative to defending an HAPC if we basically declare that large chunks of the ocean are HAPC that are neither rare or unique. So at any rate, in summary, I would urge you to vote against this motion. Thank you.
Anyone else from the council? Pat.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support the motion, and I think Dave Pierce did a good job of outlining the reasons why we should support it, so I'm not going to repeat any of those. I would just say that I do think that, I mean, as a sanctuary designation is a much higher bar to have to get over in terms of deciding that an area is rare and unique than making something an HAPC. And so certainly since the Stellwagen area did meet that, cross that bar, then I think at the very least it, designating it as an HAPC is a logical next step.
Anyone else on the council? Vito?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vito Gigoloni, Northeast Seafood Coalition. We just, on this amended motion, just wanted to talk about the precedent that can be set with this. We looked at the criterion that basically the committee had come up with, four different criterion that an area would have to meet to be designated an HAPC. And by following those exact sanctuary designation, we're looking back 10 years ago, whenever it was that the sanctuary was designated, and it was not designated with HAPC in mind. There were other political factors involved when that was done. So what we're doing here is memorializing political lines with another set of political lines. But I looked at the four criterion. Certainly the comments from the sanctuary were all about fishing impacts. It was where they were talking about the four criterion. But on the four, we don't really see where it meets any more than maybe part of criterion one. It says historical ecological function that has been lost over time and should be renewed. As far as we know, there doesn't seem to be any ecological function for fish habitat that's been lost and needs to be renewed. Importance of current eco function definitely has that, and it continues, but it says requires extensive documentation and scientific information. That part of it hasn't been met yet. Sensitivity to human activities. Sanctuary's own report indicates that much of the bottom, that they can't tell the difference between disturbance, natural disturbance, and trawl disturbances. They've said that in most of the areas. They've yet to do a qualitative analysis or quantitative analysis of where trawling impacts are actually occurring today. They haven't done that yet. So there's a pretty deliberate process under the sanctuary that is occurring. It's been going on for the last few years and will continue to go. The designation is not being redone. I guess they're just rewriting what they have right now. So in order to, there's a tremendous amounts of protections in the current designation, and we agree completely that Stellwagen is an exceptional area. That's why it's a sanctuary at this point, but it was to be protected from a lot of the things in the criterion that it's supposed to be protecting from. You can't do mining in there. You can't do dredging in there. There are a lot of things that can't be done, human impacts that are already protected by the current designation in there. So this is purely a maneuver to control fishing activity in the sanctuary. It's not to protect it from a lot of the things that we're talking about here in the four criterion. So, and four is the rarity of the habitat type. You know, there's no study that shows that what's in that designation. So basically making a statement that that entire sanctuary is rare and those substrates don't exist outside the sanctuary. So let's just say that we'd be placating to what the sanctuary is not going to be able to do for quite some time, which is to do a very deliberate public process where there are industry stakeholders involved in that, and there will be more and more protections added to the sanctuary as it goes along. They have that status. It's already there and designated. This would be to end run that, call the whole thing HAPC. If you read the comments from the sanctuary, it's to eliminate bottom trawling in a huge historic area that does not have the scientific proof that most of the bottoms that are towed right now actually change from what they would be under natural disturbance. That's their own report. So other than that, we don't have any strong opinions on this.
John Williamson.
Strong opinions in this room. John Williamson of the Ocean Conservancy. Former chairman of the Sanctuaries Advisory Council for 4 years, and someone who has spent a lot of time trying to understand the issues that are being brought up here today and what the sanctuary's authority is under the law and how that merges with fisheries management in the region. And believe me, this is an issue for sanctuaries and fishery management councils nationwide. First of all, I'd like to point out that the sanctuary system provided copious documentation on substrate and biological communities and ecological relationships within the sanctuary. The PDT's, Habitat PDT's comments on that the information provided made the analysis much more thorough, that this particular HAPC alternative has probably received the fullest analysis and the greatest documentation of any of the HAPC alternatives you have to consider. It meets all four criteria that are in Magnuson Act and the four criteria that the council has added for HAPC considerations. But as David Pierce described to everyone, I think that the alternative deserves special consideration above and beyond the biological and scientific merits of that. And it's simply that it's this, that and I've spoken to a number of people around the table about this over the last few days. There are two laws at work in the region. We're all familiar with the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which governs to a large extent, the functions of this council. The sanctuary program is working under the National Marine Sanctuaries Act. Magnuson Act, primary goal of that is fishery yield. National Marine Sanctuaries Act, it's ecological integrity, two very different program goals. The habitat planning that is envisioned under the National Marine Sanctuaries Act and what this Habitat Omnibus Amendment is about and what HAPC designation is about is one of the areas where Magnuson-Stevens Act and the National Marine Sanctuaries Act are actually running fairly much in close track as far as what their objectives are. So that's one of the reasons why we feel this is a really good opportunity for the two processes to have some constructive engagement. This is not intended to be about being an end run around the National Marine Sanctuaries designation or around this council by any means. The planning process for the Stellwagen Bank Sanctuary has been going on for 5 years. It's involved greater than 200 participants. It's had substantial industry participation from led by the Massachusetts Fishermen's Partnership in bringing people from around the Mass Bay area to be involved in the sanctuary's planning on 11 various working groups looking at various aspects of the sanctuary's plan. Paul Howard has been part of this, these working groups. David Pierce has. There may be other people at the table here as well. You have as well, Leslie Ann as well. Recreational, commercial, lobster fishermen have all been part of this planning process. The sanctuary now is going to be taking the set of recommendations that came out of that planning process, and they've begun with the conditions report that was published in April, and now we're going to see release of the management plan in phases, various aspects of the sanctuary's planning that are going to be addressed in phases. What we can probably anticipate in this is that there will be regulations that the sanctuary will request that will involve fisheries within the sanctuary. It will simply be that the sanctuary will identify issues that have to be for them to do their job under the National Sanctuaries Act, things that need to be addressed. And in the case of things that involve fisheries, the ideal course is to come to this council to say, how do we develop a regulation that will be consistent with fishery management planning in the region? That's the ideal. That's what you want to see happen. Okay. And in the case of issues that for the sanctuary that involve habitat, the Habitat Omnibus Amendment is an obvious vehicle that is already underway right now for the sanctuary program to work with this council to create strategies that are appropriate for the sanctuary and that fit with the general strategies in the region. And that's all that's happening. That's all this is about. Now, we can be sure that there will be regulations that the sanctuary has to develop under the law, the National Marine Sanctuaries Act, to fulfill its mandate. It can do it within this process, or it can do it outside this process. The alternative is for them to do that within NOAA, okay, for it to go up the chain of command and come back down the chain of command. Those of us who have worked in this process have been urging the sanctuary system to work with the New England Fishery Management Council and to do it here in a transparent process where the fishing industry can have direct involvement and where we know that the strategies that will come out of this will be consistent with what this Fishery Management Council has envisioned for managing marine quality, ecological quality for fisheries. So that's all that's at work here. This is not about an end run. Nobody has made any threats, okay? It's about creating good planning across two jurisdictions. So I urge you to support this motion. I think it's an excellent motion, and looking forward to what else gets done today. Thank you.
Vito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's Vito Calamo, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Fishery Recovery Commission. Speaking to all of you here today to alert you that I think Dr. Pierce has hit it on the head and that our leader, Pat Kirkle, also realizes what Dr. Pierce is saying. When I went to Georgetown University to testify in front of the oceans a few years back, we talked about the sanctuary. And I was a guest speaker. I think I was number 10 on the list. But at that time, the person in charge of the sanctuary works for NOAA mentioned that the sanctuary was there, Stellwagen Bank Sanctuary was there, that they would be looking at, and this is about 7 years ago, closing it to the fishing industry. Well, you know, that must have touched a nerve with Vito Calamo because in front of several hundred people, I rose up like a rocket going to the moon. And I so stated that it was the Gloucester Fisheries Commission with a vote of unanimous that supported the Stellwagen Bank Sanctuary and supported it from the drilling, the mining, the graveling, and there was one other that I forget at this time, but would be guaranteed our rights to fish forever. I hear, I read, I see the newspaper. I hear about the Trojan horse that's coming forward. But fisheries management is with you people. It's you people here that should control fisheries management. And that's what Dr. Pierce is saying. I don't like the pat on the back deal telling me there's nothing going to happen. I've been at meetings where they had actually shut me down and said to express my comments in writing. And I think it's the first time in my life that somebody ever stopped me from speaking my piece at a public meeting. So I'm not quite sure that they come in peace. I think what Dr. Pierce has said and Pat Kirkle realizes that you are the people that control fisheries. And you are the people that control the fishing industry on that Stellwagen Bank sanctuary that was supported by the fishing industry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Vito. Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolowitz, Fisheries Survival Fund. I'm against this motion. It sounds to me like most of the reasons are political. They have to do with management issues, which is supposed to be reserved for phase two. They're not scientific justifications. I think this council has the opportunity to enact measures to protect whatever aspects of the sanctuary need to be protected in phase two without the HAPC designation. Remember, you have habitat closures out there that are not HAPC designated. So you have the ability to offer whatever protections you need to any area that you manage. Now, why is this important? Because once you start making someplace an HAPC in phase one, you're supposed to be basing it on science, which means when we go into phase two, you're going to say, oh, the science is done. Everything in there is a habitat area of particular concern. I have three questions that you should ask, not only for this proposed option, but for any HAPC. The first is, Dr. Pierce said that there was an anthropogenic threat. Define the threat. What is the threat to what species in any of these proposed areas? The next question is everything in this boundary line an EFH? The point I was trying to make the first time is that we don't know, because EFH is a textual description. So not only you don't know whether it's 100% EFH within that boundary, you don't know what species are the threatened impact is going to be, under threat, and whether EFH, it's 100% of that EFH. So there are a lot of technical questions you don't have the science for to answer. And I'm just afraid that this is just like the last time where we designate HAPCs and don't understand the full consequence. So I would just say that you have to understand when you vote on something, is it 100% EFH? What is the threat? Remember, this council decided when it comes to fishing threats that that's going to be phase two. So in phase one, you don't have the scientific analysis yet to determine whether there's a fishing threat to any of these proposed HAPCs. You reserve that for phase two. The boundary, if you look at Stellwagen Bank, anybody knows that the southern boundary is high-energy mobile sand. High-energy mobile sand, and you're going to throw that into an HAPC. It does not meet the definition. I just think this process is a runaway train, and you're going to end up with problems in phase two. Thank you.
Okay, back to the council. Any further discussion or comments? Sally.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that everyone did have a chance to see the letter that came from the sanctuary. It's contained within document number four, about a quarter of the way in. It's a multi-page letter that spells out why the sanctuary believes that the area defined in this alternative, in this motion, meets not only all the criteria to be defined as an HAPC, which in fact you only have to meet one, but this actually meets all four, plus the four criteria that the council set out a couple years ago when the RFP was initially published. The threats to the area are defined in this letter. The science that justifies its designation as an HAPC is further bolstered by the existing analysis, which they reference in the letter. And you know, just to clarify, the maps and the text for the EFH, the new EFH designations, are complementary. It's been said before, but we keep having the same argument, so I need to put that out there again. The legal definition is the text. The maps help orient people who are interested in EFH to understand the general area that we're talking about. It's a means to orient us to the areas that are defined further in the text. I support this motion. I hope that people will vote in favor of it. I think that the arguments coming from lots of different angles justify further the need for this area to be designated as an HAPC, and that's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sally, anyone else? David?
I just request a roll call when the vote comes.
Any other comments? Okay. Roll call vote request has been made, so we'll take a roll call vote. Jim Salisbury.
Thanks. I suspected there might be more comment here, but I've asked this question. I'm on the committee, and I've asked this question several times, and I still have difficulty with the concept. And we've talked continually about how HAPC has to be EFH. And HAPC has to be have some particular concern that is why we're going to designate it. And my confusion, I guess, is probably a good word, but the dilemma I have is when many of these HAPCs have been, some are described as for juvenile cod or for some particular species. And then I can correlate the EFH for that particular thing with the HAPC, and you can see how, okay, we have a habitat of concern, a particular concern, and we have the EFH that is in that habitat, and it all makes sense. But when we have a HAPC that says this is habitat of particular concern and it has to be EFH, but EFH for what? What's the concern? I mean, it has to be one of the managed species that we're dealing with, so I have a hard time linking up some of these HAPCs with the EFH that would support that HAPC. And I think this is one of them. There are others. The canyons are another example of it. I think that, you know, we've kind of either missed a step or we haven't gotten to that step yet, and that step is to try to correlate specific reasons why you why that habitat is of particular concern that is correlated with some specific EFH basis. And that's where I have the problem with this. So while I sympathize with the motives or the general sense that this is an area that has great significance and it is a sanctuary, all the reasons that have been stated, I fail to see what it is. It hasn't been correlated here with what it is, what EFH that they're concerned with and what is the particular species relevance to that EFH. So that's my dilemma with these, and I think I would have to vote against this particular modification and some of the others that we expect to see. Thanks.
Is there anyone on the committee or staff that can help with this specific motion to answer that specific question as to what EFH is contained in this 6C? LA.
I can answer your question. It's on page 1296.
1296. Sally?
Well, I'm not going to. I don't have the list of the specific species, but in looking at this area, I think it is important to consider that the proposal, like I said before, meets all four of the criteria for to be designated as an HAPC plus the criteria that the council set out. So it's not. You know, one of the criteria that the council said it wanted for proposals for HAPCs was that contained juvenile cod habitat, that there was a desire to focus on that particular species. But there was also an interest in looking at areas that included multiple species to kind of get more bang for your buck. So if there was an area that had a number of species, EFH, within it, then that should receive some kind of priority consideration. Also in the HAPC guidance, ecological importance is spelled out as a criteria for determining if something should be an HAPC or not. So it's not, I think of it not just as, you know, 1 + 2 + 3 managed species equals something that is worthy of an HAPC designation, but it's the interaction of those species and kind of the cumulative way that, you know, we're able to add up all of the different criteria that go into forming an HAPC rather than just thinking 1 + 2 + 3. And I just have to add one other thing. I have to say that I think this is probably the slowest runaway train that I've ever been on.
Phil Roll and Dave Pierce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question. Well, actually, two questions. How many runaway trains you ever been on? I wonder if staff could help me out here. With, like I say, I don't apparently have enough paperwork, but the coordinates for this substitute motion kind of bother me. The reason I say that is I don't, once again, we don't have them in there, but I wonder if staff could provide them to us, because what jumps out of me here is we have important EFH going along until we hit state waters. Then it's no longer important, if that's the way I'm reading this, because it comes up against the state water line, takes a little dig, you know, so I'm sure that's just a jurisdictional thing, but I could really use some help here and some coordinates for these boxes.
Captain Howard, to that point.
I think what I got out of the last several discussions is that everything is descriptive, and you use the charts as a, you know, to go along with the description. But the description carries the weight of how it's described by text. And when and if you develop specific measures to protect areas, they will have to be in coordinates. They can't be 20-fathom line or 20-meter line. They will have to be or should be, for enforcement reasons, in coordinates. And I think I'd be happy if we could, you know, by consensus, say that when we come time to protecting areas, they'll have to be defined with coordinates. Otherwise, you can't enforce it.
I don't totally disagree with that on EFH, but on the HAPC things, I run into. I can disagree with that.
LA to that point.
Yeah, after you decide what is HAPC, there will be coordinates in the document. We will produce the coordinates that go along with whatever lines you decide on. Also, if I may, to Jim Salisbury's question about sort of getting wrapped around what the threat is, on this particular one, and as on every other one, we've done the best that we can, and I think it's pretty thorough to identify as much as we can qualitatively what are the threats in each area. As Ron points out, you know, it's hard to quantify threats. Well, he didn't point that out, but he pointed out threats. I say it's hard to quantify threats, but
On this one, it starts on page, there's like 1,297, and it goes on. But it's not just, you know, the threat are clearly spelled out in that text. And you're right, there is no connection between that threat and juvenile, you know, winter flounder EFH, which it was recognized when these HAPC proposals were put together that they were mostly based on, or a lot of them were based on features, so, and which include a range of habitat types. So there's two of them in the document that are species specific. The 0 to 20 meter juvenile cod one is one example, which goes to Phil's question about what happens when you run up against the state lines, state water boundary. We take over with an inshore juvenile cod HAPC, which covers that area inside 3 miles. That's 20 meters and shallower. So, I mean, I guess I would argue that the document does at least qualitatively discuss those threats.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Jim Salisbury asked a question regarding the species that might be within the sanctuary that would enable us to say it's essential fish habitat for those particular species. I have a copy of the condition report that was put out by the sanctuary back in April of this year, and you know, they list the species that are of concern to them because they are within the various habitat within the sanctuary, 15 or so species, and, of course, not just groundfish. But the groundfish that they've identified, and we really know this ourselves, but I'll state it anyways, you know, white hake and pollock, winter flounder, cod, windowpane flounder, yellowtail flounder, haddock, American plaice, witch flounder, red hake, and then others. So it's a very important habitat for a wide range of species that, of course, seasonally habitat the sanctuary, and in some cases, of course, year-round they habitat the sanctuary. They're found within the sanctuary. Cod is identified as a keystone species. Of course, cod is not everywhere within the sanctuary, but I think it's safe to say that they're almost everywhere within the sanctuary, depending upon the time of the year, tending to frequent the harder bottom more so than the softer bottom, but, you know, you'll find them. Yellowtail flounder as well, of course, on the sandy substrates, on the mud substrates. So it's a potpourri of habitat that can clearly be called EFH for those particular groundfish species, and to carry it further, again, as I said before, the uniqueness of this area, the designation that it has, I feel, still begs for this HAPC designation, and then working with the sanctuary to determine what then happens within the sanctuary for fishing gear use. And, of course, the sanctuary will use the designation for other purposes that go beyond what might be considered for possible future restrictions on fishing within the sanctuary.
Jim.
Well, I'd like to try again a little bit. I understand the concerns and the general appreciation for this particular area. And I understand that there are all kinds of fish stocks in there, and there's going to be EFH for something in almost every part of it. Every part of it will likely as not be an EFH for some stage, life stage, or one of the species we manage. But where, I think Paul's comment, you know, when we ask, well, EFH, how do you designate where EFH is? Is it the descriptive area? And we said, no, yes, it's just the descriptive area. Well, how do you draw the lines? Well, this is the point where we start drawing the lines. This is where you say EFH is going to be these lines, whatever they are. So that, to me, is where you have to start saying why and what you're going to do it. This is why, one of the reasons why I argued that I thought part of the phase two, dividing it here is inappropriate, that this ought to be in a phase two section where you say, here's why we want to consider this HAPC. This is why it's a valuable place, why it's unique, why it's different than other EFH of the same kind. And so we want to treat it some way specially. So I think when you, there's a time to do that. My problem is I don't think we've got there yet, but we're going to draw the line first, and then we're going to have a dilemma, I think, at some point. Some of this isn't going to be EFH for the reasons you drew the line for. And this is where we get into where Ron's concern is. It's not that you're against having an HAPC. It's against setting it up before you figure out why this habitat is of particular concern for what. That's where I have trouble. Now, I understand. Others may not. Others may be perfectly satisfied to do this. Say, well, I know it's a concern, and it's a beautiful place, and we're gonna preserve it. But to me, the law says we need to specify why it's a particular concern, why it's rare, for what, and why it's somehow distinguished from other EFH that we're concerned about. So that's where I have a difficulty. We're drawing this line prematurely, and I must say it's somewhat of a generic difficulty. It's not specifically to this motion, but it applies to this. Thank you.
Anyone else? Anyone who hasn't commented? Okay. Paul Howard, please conduct a roll call vote.
Please read the motion on the board and answer yes, no, or abstain. Rodney Avila. Rip Cunningham. David Pierce.
Yes.
David Gafel.
No.
Tom Hill.
No.
Mike Leary.
No.
Sally McGee.
Yes.
Pat Kirkle.
Yes.
Terry Stockwell.
Yes.
John Nelson.
No.
Jimmy Ottolin.
No.
David Preble.
Yes.
Dana Rice.
No.
Phil Rule.
No.
Jim Salisbury.
No.
David Simpson.
Yes.
And April Valliere.
Yes.
8-9. Motion fails 8-9.
Okay, we've been going for an hour and 45 minutes, so we'll take a 10-minute break. Clear your head, stretch your legs. Okay, we're back on the original motion. The attempt to amend did not pass before the break, so we're back on the main motion. Any comments? Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to also introduce a motion to amend. I'd like to move to include in the Phase 1 DEIS a modified HAPC Alternative 8 to include only areas identified as juvenile Atlantic cod EFH. And if I get a second, I'd like to address that.
Second by Rip Cunningham. Okay, Dave.
Okay, the over the last 2.5 decades, I've stood by and witnessed the total devastation of the southern New England cod population in an area that traditionally had a substantial cod fishery. And at this point, there's virtually nothing left. We had a little glimmering of cod this spring, a lot of fish on a very small area, but nothing that would qualify as any sort of a recovery. We know that the Great South Channel is, to a great extent, the linchpin of our cod recovery. We know that that has to be protected for our cod recovery. If we look at Alternative 8, Alternative 8, as it was originally outlined, was a very large, what we call a big box area. It includes areas that are vital to the recovery of the cod in southern New England, but it also includes a lot of areas that are probably not. So the area, the Alternative 8, as it was originally presented, was overly broad, and not all of it would be considered cod EFH. So, but we still need to protect something there. So the best way to do this, since what we need to protect is juvenile cod, if we take Alternative 3E, which is the EFH for juvenile cod, and we superimpose that on Alternative 8, then we wind up with approximately one-third of the big box, which is truly essential habitat, truly habitat that qualifies, in fact, by all of the criteria to become habitat area of particular concern. So that's the proposal, and that's what I'm putting forward.
Dave, I had a question. You referred to
I'm sorry.
Alternative 3E. Alternative 3E is the Hydrographer Canyon.
No, juvenile cod EFH Alternative 3E. I'm sorry, I misstated that. Juvenile cod EFH for Alternative 3E on the juvenile cod EFH designation. And I did pass out a map here that indicates, that takes the big box and it superimposes on the big box the juvenile cod EFH, not HAP, HAPC. And if you look at the map that I distributed, it has the big box outlined in black that includes a great south channel, and then superimposed on it is the alternative 3E for essential fish habitat for juvenile cod. And what we arrive at is an area of the Great South Channel that would qualify across the board for habitat area of particular concern. And I think Leslie Ann has that on her computer.
LA?
Just quickly before I switch from her screen to mine, I don't think she knew who seconded it. Rip.
Okay. Rip seconded it.
Rip Cunningham seconded the motion. While we're waiting for the graphic, any other comments or questions from council members? Dr. Pierce.
The Habitat Technical Committee, have they weighed in any way, shape, or form that would help us judge whether or not this motion would indeed include HAPC for juvenile cod in that area?
Any committee members or staff wish to comment on that question? LA?
Well, if you recall, back to January, the committee meeting that where the council meeting where the committee reported and added this into the document, the PDT created two options for this Great South Channel HAPC were not ultimately included into the DSCIS, but they're just this big box split in half by the 50-meter contour. There was a Great South Channel East and a Great South Channel West. And that was the only refinement that we offered at that time. However, I will note that Juvenile Alternative 3E was based on the habitat approach. So it includes not only just survey information, but all of the other habitat variables as well. And that was the one you just approved.
Anyone else on the council? Sally?
Yeah, just to make sure this is clear, the overlay that we're talking about is the large area that was defined in the Great South Channel, but then the subset that's defined is what was the committee preferred alternative for the new juvenile cod EFH designation, which we just approved in the previous motion. So it's focusing, which was the direction that had been given by the PDT to the proposers of this this HAPC that was deemed much too broad, and it's focusing using especially one of the criteria that was laid out by the council 2 years ago, that HAPCs should focus on juvenile cod EFH.
Dave Gaethel.
You know, this is somewhat of a procedural question. I'm just curious if this could be remanded back to the committee, and then that would give the PDT a chance to look at it and then include it as part of phase two. Because basically we're going to be flying here now without any scientific guidance whatsoever. It's going to be pretty much a judgment call based on your own personal beliefs. You know, would that be a problem that this get brought along as the sole holdover from the first phase of this and just include it in the second phase, and that would give us a chance to have it analyzed and see if it does, in fact, do what we're hoping to do.
Yeah, I had a similar question, I guess. I do remember when we last looked at these alternatives, I asked the question how we arrived at such a great big box, an alternative eight. And I remember specifically being told that this is just, in a sense, a placeholder for the Great South Channel area, and that we could, in fact, go with a smaller area. But your point is well taken. Jim Odlin, then Dr. Pierce, and then Dave Simpson.
I'm opposed to this motion. I can't find anything or that jumps out at me. Why is this juvenile card, if I see all this shaded area in the document of juvenile card all up and down the coast on the eastern end of Georgia's all the way over to around Nantucket and Block Island? Why are we picking just a small area in the middle of the channel to say it's a juvenile card of central fish habitat when there's much more area somewhere else on the fly here, right? Just why is this particular area that much more important than all the other shaded areas in this page? Because this is really all I have to work from right now. So I'm opposed to it for that reason. Thank you.
Dr. Pierce.
Well, I was certainly opposed to the larger polygon that was too all-encompassing and really, as far as I was concerned, didn't include habitat that I would consider to be critical for juvenile cod. However, this alternative I find to be very attractive, and the reason why is that before I came here, I rummaged through my office to find a document that I knew that I had, and to my great surprise, I found it. And it's a lab reference. It's a technical memorandum, actually. This is July 1991. I save everything, especially if it relates to codfish. Distribution of sexually immature components of 10 Northwest Atlantic groundfish species based on the Northeast Fisheries Center bottom trawl survey, 1968 through 1986. I knew it would come in handy someday. And I go to the figures that show distribution of the juvenile codfish based on the spring and the fall bottom trawl survey cruises for that long time period when we did have a lot of cod on Georgia's Bank as opposed to now. And it overlaps beautifully with the blackened boxes that are shown on the screen. Obviously, there's no way to say it's one for one, but visually to me, and I know no one around the table has it, has this document, but it convinces me that indeed, especially with what Leslie Ann said, that this 3E, EFH, alternative 3E, draws on habitat considerations, correct? You said that, Leslie Ann? Yes. All right, so with that said, that provides me with even more confidence that indeed, you know, this motion is appropriate, so I will support it.
L.A. and then Dave.
I just wanted to respond to Jimmy Odlin's comment about, I think it was yours about sending it back to the PDT. Is that your comment? Somebody's comment. Dave, sorry. You know, in full disclosure, I'm not really sure what the PDT would say about this, because if you recall, way back at the beginning when we had all these HAPC proposals, we had one from the Conservation Law Foundation that we rejected. The PDT recommended it be rejected, and the committee ended up not in the document. But it was constructed based on a modeling system, a Mark Sand modeling system, and it highlighted a number of areas that were important based solely on how much EFH was in that particular area. That's, you know, and you had to take all the pieces together to make the solution valid. And the PDT's comment on that one was there was nothing accompanying the area other than the fact that it was EFH, and there was nothing specific to the criteria or specific to the threats that was described in the proposal. So it was just based in HAPC based on where a lot of EFH is. And so we recommend it not be included because of that reason. And I'm pretty sure the PDT would say a similar thing about this, is that it's solely based on an EFH designation. And if it has to, it needs, in our opinion, needs to have more accompanying information about the other, how it addresses the criteria in the document, other than the fact that it's juvenile cod EFH. So I guess I'm giving you a little bit of a glimpse of what you'd probably get back from us if you sent it back to us.
Dave Simpson, then Terry, then John Nelson.
Yeah, I guess I was looking to learn a little bit more about the difference going out to 50 meters, and alternative 7B, which was crafted for juvenile cod habitat, that goes to 20 meters. Our choice there was 10 meters off the beach or out to 20 meters, and 20 meters so far is, you know, is what the council is going towards. So why out to 50 along the beach, and then why include that area that is sort of in the center of the Great South Channel?
Ellie?
I'm going to help Dave out here. If you look at the image that's up on the screen, and I might be a tiny bit off, but the juvenile cod EFH right here, this boundary line seems to be the 50-meter contour line, and everything to the west pretty much is shallower than 50 meters. So, no, I think white is shallower. Right. The channel gets deeper, and the juvenile cod EFH text description, hold on a second, is the original depth description is 1 to 120 meters, so it includes that area, but then it's modified based on the habitat requirements, which include, I don't think it includes, so that's why you're seeing that white area.
Terry?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I answered one of my questions, but actually I'm intrigued by this proposal. It addresses most of what Jim Salisbury brought up in our last discussion and refines alternative 8, and I can support this measure.
John Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the question it does revolve around process, though. All the other HAPCs, EFH, have all gone through a technical review, and I think that it would be very wise for this council to continue that process rather than inventing something on the fly. I think the motion should merely reflect, if it's voted in, that the intent of the council is to send this to the PDT for further review and consideration by the Habitat Committee under Phase 2, after which the Council will make a decision on whether or not it would continue as a candidate for HAPC. I know that's somewhat wordy, but the process is the point that I'm trying to get across. If you arbitrarily say, yeah, this looks great, and I would point out that this essential fish habitat for the juveniles is much more extensive than the other one that we have in there in the plan, and if this is substituting for the other one, then I think we ought to be careful about that. I would rather see the one that was already designated as HAPC, I think goes out to 50 feet, for the juvenile cod, and this one be reviewed by the PDT. If we don't have the review, then you don't have the scientific basis to continue the discussion and then come up with management measures on it. We ran into that problem on ASMFC, and we have a firm rule: you do not vote on something unless it's got a technical review, and you can vote then however you want, but at least you have a technical review of it. And I would recommend we have the technical review. So that means you carry it forward, but get technical review, and then decide whether it's worth carrying forward.
Probably going to come back to you, John, to see if we might be able to amend this after. I'm going to step into the audience for some comment. I had Jim Salisbury in the council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support the concept of this motion, and I think it's getting to the point I was trying to make earlier. I would like to see, however, that it be reviewed, and I think an important point to do in that review is when it comes back as a proposed HAPC, it ought to come back with some defined lines, not just the depth contour, because we get back to Paul's comments. Once you get into dealing with something that you are conceivably going to manage, or you're going to do some management activity, and I think you need some fairly defined lines. So it would be easy to do, and it would come back much in the order as we have the existing HAPCs. You'd define the criteria you want, and then you'd just draw a box around where it's 90%. I think we use 90% for the frequency rates in the survey. So, the TDT could recommend a rectangular or some sort of straight line box that would cover it. So I would support John's concept of sending it back and including it in the second phase for further development. Thank you.
Sally, and then I'm going to go to the audience.
I think this alternative, while it's not something specifically that we've talked about, is an alternative that we could have very well anticipated, given that we're changing all the EFH designations and the priority that's been set on juvenile COD EFH. I think putting this into phase two gets into the problems that we've talked about for 2 years now, and the reason that this whole action was split in two, and that was to have phase one be the designations, the EFH designations and the HAPC designations, figure out what's essential and figure out what is of particular concern and use a scientific basis to make those determinations. Once that's been done, then when we get into the tough and the political discussions in phase two. And my concern is if we take this action into phase two, then we're going to our vision will be clouded by the political and not steered by the scientific. I disagree that with some statements that have been made that this is not scientifically based. It's actually the preferred alternative, which we voted forward in the previous motion for the new EFH designation for juvenile COD, is among the best that we have. Those alternative threes that we were selecting from were the best ones. Those were the ones where the PDT was able to, with a peer review, come up with more ways to incorporate more variables into defining EFH. So it's the best definition of EFH that we have from all the alternatives that we were able to select. So I would really be hesitant to put this off into phase two because it's just going to get really muddy.
Okay, I'm going to LA, and then I'm going to the audience.
Well, of course, there's another alternative, which is, the boundary line between phase one and phase two is somewhat ambiguous. So there's nothing to say that the PDT can't go do a technical analysis and come back in September, not part of phase two, and provide you with something. Just that's another alternative.
Is that another option you're throwing on the table, LA? Okay. Okay, in the audience, who do I have? Dave Ferula, then Gib Brogan, then Ron Smolowitz.
David Ferula for the Fisheries Survival Fund. It's kind of difficult to comment on an option that hasn't appeared in the document, but I'll try. The Habitat PDT had provided the following guidance. At the time, the PDT has no information with which to refine the HAPC, which is alternative 8, and no site-specific information on juvenile COD to support this designation. Based on the information that was contained in your document, we had submitted comments which focused on depth contours. You have a 20-meter option in your document as an alternative, which is predominantly where the young of the year are. We've explained that. That could go to 40, but to start picking and choosing and creating sort of a mosaic of blocks that spread all over the channel, that's going to get awfully hard to manage with. And we would oppose it on that basis. SMAST has done an extensive amount of benthic surveying out there and identified a 50-meter line as the one place to look where the habitat composition essentially, the benthic composition changes. The currents get swifter. You get into sand and gravel rather than more complex bottom. 40 seems to be, according to the straw man paper, more tied to cod, juvenile cod, that was presented when a big box was provided. So I would urge you to not go down this road. Again, it's to come here to make these kinds of decisions on the fly when nobody can even put a map up which shows what it frankly looks like seems to be a little much. So we would definitely oppose that.
Gib Brogan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gib Brogan with Oceana. We support this approach and the modification to this area, this HAPC. The background of this one was it was originally proposed as a series of small polygons in the Great South Channel. That was criticized as being too small and unmanageable. It went to being a larger polygon that was criticized by the PDT as being overly broad and not getting at the stated purpose for managing juvenile cod EFH. And this filter here applies specifically that filter to this area. And I think that it gets at that issue, the key issue of preserving and designating juvenile cod EFH as HAPC. As far as the scientific justification for this, this area has been identified as important to juvenile cod for quite a long while, starting with the study that Dr. Pierce cited. Moving on to 1999, the Habitat Tech team said that in part, this is the most important Atlantic cod habitat in the region and is thought to be very sensitive to the disturbances associated with bottom-tending mobile fishing gear. That gets right at a lot of the criteria that were laid out for HAPC designation. This is a key area and should be put forward as a focus for the Phase 2, something that is sometimes muddied in this process is the designation and the management phase of things. And I hope that this council will keep those two phases very separate, look at the merits of this area, designate it as HAPC, and then we can spend the management phase, the long two-year, what looks to be a two-year process, looking at the effects of gear on this area, coming up with appropriate gears in the appropriate areas. We realize that it's not going to be a black and white issue, open area, closed area, that there are going to be shades of gray in this area, and that we can conserve EFH and allow fishing to go on in appropriate areas. Thanks very much.
Ron Smallwoods.
Ron Smallwoods, Fisheries Survival Fund. Dave Fula did read from the June 4th, 2007 memo to PDT. Just to complete that sentence, at this time the PDT has no information for which to refine this HAPC and no site-specific information on juvenile cod to support this designation. No site-specific information. If you go into the survey database, you have to be aware of several things. First, in a document that Dr. Pierce referred to, they're counting fish at 15 centimeters as juveniles. Most of the habitat documentation are young of the year fish that newly settled to the bottom. If you look at the scientific papers, the overwhelming survey evidence is those fish are in 3 to 30 feet of water. That's where the inshore HAPC comes into play for protecting juvenile cod. The main threat, in my view, and if you go on to the internet and study the scientific papers, is water quality. The impact of the coastal zone, the quality of the water in 3 to 30 feet of depth. In the channel, if you look at the SMAS surveys, it has some of the highest fishing effort from the NIMS VMS data, but it also has the highest vertical epifauna in the areas that are the most heavily fished. If you start looking at it in 1 mile squares, you start seeing why. A vast portion of that bottom is untowable. So in defining an HAPC, you need to identify the threat. There's no threat there. The rarity, it's far from rare bottom. That's been documented scientifically. That's the conundrum the PDT has. That's how come they could not draw boxes. I think it's really wrong for this council to vote up on this particular action. Thank you.
John Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Williamson, Ocean Conservancy. The designation of HAPC is a valuable way to highlight priority areas within EFH for conservation and management. It's a quote from the final EFH final rule. I think that that should be the thought process of behind this council's thought process behind any of these HAPC alternatives. This area, people have long agreed, has some special significance for juvenile cod. We're still learning how to identify that significance and the process for developing regulations or management approach around an HAPC designation in the Great South Channel area is going to be a creative process for this council. I really urge that this council look at this as a creative process that is going to unfold over the next year and a half. We know that this area of the Great South Channel is important. That's why a big box was drawn around it, because we are still trying to get a handle on how to best define the area within that big box that most deserves attention. The alternative that's now being put for you to focus on the EFH for adult and juvenile cod in that area, in that big box, seems a significant refinement for that approach. And it opens up a range of creative possibilities for this council to create incentives for people to fish in that area with specialized gear types, to do some really creative work, to begin to move people toward managing that area with a lesser fishing footprint, and still allow the full range of fishing activities that are there now. So we would strongly support the development of the designation of an HAPC for the Great South Channel area, and support its continued development in the process. Thanks.
Okay, back to the council. Just for the record, one of the members of the public commented that we didn't have a chart up. There was a chart up on the screen. It wasn't part of the documents that the public had, but there was a chart up on the screen. That's just for the record. I had a question. In the decision document on page 5, the goal 2, I guess the council motion, there's reference that says alternative 4 as modified to be the current Cashers Ledge habitat closed area. Where did that modification, what does that mean, as modified? LA?
It happened at the committee. It essentially takes the current habitat, the HAPC that's the alternative, and makes it smaller.
So that happened at the last committee meeting?
Yes.
Okay.
But when we went out to the public, it was noted at the last council meeting before we went out to the public that these HAPC alternatives were as large as they could be, but that they could be made smaller after public comment.
Okay, so that situation is similar to the situation we're discussing right now with alternative 8 and then a subset of that. And that modification occurred at the last committee meeting. When was the last committee meeting?
June 5th. And the alternative... Right, June 5th.
And what was the rationale for shrinking it?
You'll have to ask the maker of the motion, which was Dave Gaethel.
It was the same rationale for the Jeffries Middle Bank area. It was that was the area that included the rare and unique habitat, and it included a sample of the other habitats as well, that the bigger area was mostly low-impact habitats.
Okay. So the committee did modify an alternative that went out to the public, and right now we're discussing whether the council wants to modify an alternative that went out to the public. So it's the same thing. Okay. Anyone else on the council? John Nelson.
I'd like to try a friendly amendment, Mr. Chairman.
To be determined. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know. And it's up on the board right there. It's merely saying to forward a modified HAPC alternative 8 Great South Channel to include only areas that are juvenile cod EFH alternative 3. 2, the PDT. And Habitat Committee for review and recommendation.
You're expecting that to come back at the September council?
Yeah, that's based on what staff has provided. Then we would be looking at that in September. Okay. And I just ask if that could be considered as a friendly amendment so that we can avoid the parliamentary amendment.
Okay. Should the same thing apply to alternative four? And if the point is that the technical review hasn't happened, shouldn't we be consistent across all the alternatives? Or does the council feel satisfied that a modified alternative four is acceptable in this case?
I just
throw that out on the table.
Yeah, well, I think we ought to deal with one at a time, Mr. Chairman, and then we can certainly address your questions.
To the maker of the motion and the seconder, do you accept that as a friendly?
No. Now, I would only accept that if it were absolutely clear that it would still remain in Phase 1. I would be very much opposed to confusing the roles of Phase 1 and Phase 2. I don't think there's an emergency here. I think that we could do it in the way that Mr. Nelson recommends, but it would have to be very, very clear that it's a part of Phase 1 and not being put off and included in Phase 2. It's my understanding that with any of these that it's possible to go smaller at any time. And it's evident that we need to do something for the Great South Channel in terms of habitat areas special concern, particular concern, and that the big box is, for a number of reasons, unacceptable. So what I've done here is to simply try to reduce it at this point through a modification, which is, as was pointed out, similar to a modification we've already done today. So it would have to, bottom line is it would have to be totally clear that it's a part of Phase 1.
Paul?
How I interpret this is that the PDT will go back and analyze this alternative and see and bring back to the council in September how it meets the criteria, the council's criteria and the HAPC criteria. And then the council will decide in September, will vote it up or down, and Phase 1 ends. And then Phase 2 begins the very next day, where the council will decide on what we've designated as EFH and what we've designated as HAPC. What measures do you want to use to protect it? So that means also that we should be aware that that Great South Channel is designated right now as EFH.
Right.
So you can put measures in it to protect it as EFH. That we shouldn't think as council members that the only measures, the only designations we're going to protect are HAPC. That's not so. They may need more protection than just a no-trawl zone like we have in EFH. They may not. But you can protect EFH, too, like we've always been protecting.
So what I'm hearing is that it is still going to be a part of Phase 1.
Yes.
In that case, then, I would consider it a friendly amendment.
Seconder agree?
Yes.
Seconder agrees. It's a friendly amendment. Too much debate. I'm going to call the question. Sally McGee.
Just a clarification, does this mean that now Phase 1 won't be completed until September?
Yes. Okay, I'm going to call a question. Make sure the motion's up on the board. Okay, everybody's clear? All those in favor of the motion to amend, please raise your hand. Thirteen. Opposed? Four opposed. Abstentions? One abstention. No? Dennis?
Okay. I guess I'm asking the same question Sally was. Does this mean that you will not move this forward then, phase one, to the... I guess you don't move it forward, though. It's going to be a package before it goes forward. Is that correct? So before you move it forward to the secretary, both phase one and phase two will have to be completed. Is that correct?
That's the way it was advertised.
So, okay, so then you will just finalize phase one, not now, but in September, as things stand right now. I just need
phase
to get clear.
Phase
when
two
I go
isn't
back.
Scheduled for a final vote, I don't believe, until 2009. Is that right? So we're not going to forward anything for regulation until then, unless I'm misspeaking. Paul Howard, before the vote carried 13-4, for the record, the vote to amend. Paul.
I envision that the only thing we're going to do is this. We're not going to revisit anything else. Today was to vote on the whole package, but there's one now that was going to come back for a final vote. And then we put it to bed and now develop measures for a year. And then we submit at the end of the year. So 2008 will be our... You should be able to do it in a year. You know what's EFH. You know what you have to protect, HAPC. Get it done. You don't have to wait till 2009. We've already been, 10 years on this?
Okay, so we're back on the main motion. L.A.
I just want to clarify your comment earlier about Alternative 4 being modified. Alternative 4, the modification for Alternative 4 only encompasses the existing habitat closed area. And nothing else. And the discussion around the table and the justification under the committee motion stated that due to the analysis that had already been done under the habitat closed area in Amendment 13, that they were basing that motion on that analysis. So it just to point that out.
Thank you for clarifying that. We're back on the main motion. Phil Rule.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Held back a little bit, but I'm going to have to vote against this for the same reason I said before. And to Paul's point, the text, might describe it, but I got to heed your warning from earlier this year. What we did in 42, when we voted on box on piece of paper with no coordinates involved, right? We found out right after the fact we had a problem. We couldn't fix that problem. It burns still heavily on me. It's to the point of the text. I had to take everybody back to this morning, the discussion of ITQ. That's text. That's what it says. And I heard a whole lot of opinions on exactly what it said this morning. So I got to oppose this.
Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Given the discussion we've just had on two specific parts of the Gulf here, can any member of the committee please help me out with why every single canyon was identified as an HAPC, including the expanded boxes?
Anyone on the committee? David?
Yeah, it was based on the public comment. And it was for the coral. And, that was the presence-absence is what we had to go by, basically. And the documentation we were provided by both the PDT and members of the public, which included basically both sides of the debate.
And the ration for expanding those boxes was for coral and those entire expansion areas in the big boxes where you clustered together the three canyons?
That was based on public comment that in those particular boxes, that by just including the boundaries of the canyons, where the canyons were so close together, that you'd miss a lot of valuable habitat of particular concern, that it wasn't, the analysis of them as individual small boxes was less than the sum of the whole. I think that's the easiest way to describe it.
Anyone else? Okay, we're back on the main motion. Jim Salisbury.
Thanks. Again, this is one that highlights my earlier comment that I can understand that it's designed as, or it's thought to be of particular concern because of the rarity, the corals, but again, how this correlates to EFH and what you know, how we don't have any EFH for coral, so what, how does this correlate here to our EFH basis? That's where, again, I get back into some dilemma. So I think if we were trying to protect corals, that might be a valuable exercise to do, and it can be done. Just, you know, you can do it to protect anything. But again, I have this particular problem of designating a large area, picking out some species that isn't part of the EFH, you know, our EFH basis, and saying that we're doing this as an HAPC, which has to be an EFH for something. So how I have a difficult time wrapping my mind around how you'd say, well, it's EFH for hake that goes down to now 2,000 fathoms. What does that have to do with the coral? So as far as an HAPC. So this is where I think that we have a little disconnect here in our procedures, and with all due respect to the people who think that we shouldn't have phase two deal with the scientific issues, I think if we don't, then we have to do it all in one, and we haven't done it here. So I have some problem with this. Thank you.
April.
Yeah, I'm glad Terry raised that point, because I had the same question about these large canyon areas. With all the others, you have these maps with the distribution from eggs, larvae, juvenile, adults. And I don't know, because I haven't been at the table that often, but to me it's a big red flag, these giant areas. They're not that close together. Some of them are, you know, maybe on a map it looks like they're close together, but I just have some concerns about that and the documentation that would go along with it to just include these in at this point in time. And I don't know, again, as Terry started to ask the question, maybe somebody else can help me out here, but I'm not quite sure that this is – I know it started out as for protection of corals, but I don't know where it's coming from right now.
Dr. Stevenson.
The HAPC alternatives for the canyons are not designed to protect corals, per se. They're designed to – actually not designed to protect anything. They're just designations. They're designed to designate areas in which deep canyon habitat areas exist, which are – EFH for, right at this point with the old definitions, the old designations, it's just a handful of species. But corals are one of the structure-forming organisms that are present in some of these canyons. And what the document does is to explain and show on the maps what structure-forming organisms, including corals, are present, are known to be present in each of these canyons. And so I want to make that clear to everyone. I mean, people are certainly thinking about corals, but an HAPC cannot be put forward as a coral protection measure and without being connected to EFH.
Pat?
Well, that last part actually is no longer true with the reauthorization of the Magnuson Act, where Congress did include specific language that allows for the designation and protection of deep sea corals separate from EFH. So that's a fairly new provision of the Act.
Sally, you've had your hand up.
Yeah, I was just going to point out what Pat just did, that in addition to protecting or identifying EFH within those areas, that there are discretionary provisions to identify areas in which deep-sea corals exist. So that's new. It's something that I think this council has anticipated for a while, especially through the last Monkfish Amendment where we took action to identify areas where deep water corals were known to exist. So I think, you know, the council was kind of ahead of the game in some respects and anticipated, knowingly or not, that there was going to be this amendment to the Magnuson Act that said you should, if you want to, discretionary provisions, do what you can to protect deep water corals. On top of the new, several of the new EFH designations go into this area where we didn't have EFH designations before simply because we didn't have the data for it, but now we do. And so a number of more species, more than just the handful that Dave Stevenson mentioned, are designated now with the previous motion in the canyons.
Jim Salisbury.
Well, I recognize that Magnuson Act would allows us to consider corals. I don't see that this is necessarily the mechanism or properly the mechanism to do that. If I were to try to describe my connection, I could see how you could say, let's say it's EFH for hake, and hake requires to feed on coral. So now, because the coral is there, that's EFH for hake. Sure, it's a valuable thing to do, but we can't just, I don't think we should just take and torque the whole action here to say, well, you know, we'd like to throw in corals along with everything else, and therefore let's just do it anyway. I think that we have gone through a fairly rigorous process of very carefully trying to define EFH in a very expansive way, and our HAPCs should be have to have EFH involved in it for something, so I think we should stick to that. And we can do something for corals on the side, but or I shouldn't say on the side, that sounds like passing it off, but I think we can do it specifically, but not through this mechanism. We can still designate canyons for EFH. There is EFH there, and we can still designate them for some particular species that we have a concern about or some activity that we have a concern about relative to those species, but this is where I think we stray from the real scientific basis of our exercise. Thank you.
Rodney?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at this this map on Alternative 3 where all the canyons are blocked off. I spent a day or two out in those canyons, and the coral is in the tips of the canyons in 200 fathom. That's where they are. There's nothing on the bottom of those. And it looks to me like everything was just broad brushed. If you take Oceanographer, Gilbert, and Lydonia, it looks like each canyon was identified and then a big square box over the top of it. It takes everything away. And if you go to Atlantis and Alvin, it's the same situation here. So I think it's like a bigger chunk of the pie than what we need to protect this area. Thank you.
Sally.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that this motion passed the committee unanimously. And, that's all.
Dave Pearson.
Well, David Stevenson made the point that I wanted to make, and that's the fact that we need to be concerned about significant 3D structure. 3D structure on the bottom that provides habitat for a variety of species of fish, groundfish, and the like. And where do we find unique 3D structure that is easily damaged by mobile gear? I'll be very specific with regard to mobile gear. In the canyons. In the document, we see that we're not just referencing 3D structure as corals. We're going beyond that. We're talking about sea pens and sponges and a variety of other deep sea life that provides significant 3D structure. So if anything can be termed HAPC, I would suggest that, you know, these canyons can be called HAPC. Granted, the boundaries are tough, but these are the boundaries that, you know, we've been working with. These are the boundaries that went to public hearing, and as indicated, the committee has already, you know, supported these particular strategies. So my attention for the longest of times has also been drawn specific to corals. If you recall, maybe 2 years ago, I forget now, the Canadians actually implemented some specific closures in their waters to protect deep-sea corals. Papers were published. We had those papers circulated amongst council members. So time has now passed, and perhaps we've gotten a little fuzzy with regard to the nature of that particular research and, of course, what the Canadians did, which I thought and others thought at the time was a very wise decision. So now we're going in that direction as well through HAPC designation with the intent to protect this very significant 3D structure that can be very easily damaged, if not destroyed, and it won't come back for a long time because of the very slow growth of these particular organisms at those great depths.
Anything new? Dennis?
Quickly on the Mid-Atlantic Council's position on this. We discussed it at least briefly at our last meeting. I updated them on last week on what the council or what the committee had done the previous week and pointed out to them that I thought you would be finishing phase one at this meeting, but maybe not. But and I also pointed out to them that they had been kept very well appraised. Leslie Ann had been down, I didn't realize, five times, but she had been down several times, and that we had had a public hearing on it. And the feeling I got out of the council was they didn't have any problems with the essential fish habitat, but there were some who had concerns over the HAPCs in the canyon areas and how much might be encompassed in phase two into those HAPCs. I think you will be getting correspondence from the Mid-Atlantic Council, so I'm not going to go any further into what I think their position is on it.
Anyone who hasn't commented? Come on, Bonnie.
Thank you. Bonnie Spinazzola, Atlantic Offshore Lobstermen's Association. Let me just get through all of my stuff here. Okay. First of all, I guess a rhetorical question would be, since EFH will not be identified by a Latin long, would that mean if management is put in place for the protection of certain EFH, the management would be throughout the entire HAPC? Now, I know that we're not necessarily talking about management yet, but that's just a question to think about, certainly one that I'm thinking about, and what that would mean to anyone fishing in and around or within that HAPC. Secondly, I have a concern with using, as someone over here, I think Rodney said, a broad brush to identify the HAPCs, especially by analogy or association. Lumping the three canyons together, again, is frankly not even a broad brush. It just goes way beyond that. If you look, frankly, in the document that was sent out and you look at just using Oceanographers Gilbert and Lydonia for an example, you can see where Oceanographers and Lydonia does have coral in it, or does have structures of some type in it, and then you look at Gilbert, and it's practically devoid of anything, and yet it's all being lumped together. To bring things together by association, I think, is quite dangerous. And I've been told, certainly by the people that are fishing there, that the substrate certainly is not always the same when you're looking at one canyon or another, even if they're right next to each other. The other thing I'd like to say is, let's see, certainly I have a concern for EFH with a purely textual identification as a baseline to create a management area when you don't have actual data, actual, you know, information that tells you and shows you and you know exactly what you're pinpointing. I think it gets quite dangerous, especially when you're looking at managing a large area, and especially when you're looking at managing the canyons across the entire continental shelf, as this document seeks to do. Finally, the best information within the canyons is poor at best. I think we all pretty much know that. There are some canyons where there is good information, but very, very few of them. The council discussion document, document number 5, page 6, paragraph 3.2, identifies the lack of data in that it says, and I'm pulling out a small part of it, but it says ones that have been least explored may have less data on which to base the HAPC, such as Hydrographer, Veatch, Hudson, and Washington Canyons. Yet all of those are identified as areas that should be HAPC. Do we know why? Frankly, when the question was asked of the committee earlier, can someone explain why these were identified as areas that should be HAPC? For quite a long time, there was silence. Then the answer came out as coral. I actually spoke with Barbara Hecker last night, and I have a document of hers, which is a NOAA document. It's a NOAA article, actually. It's explorations. She went down in the Alvin with Les Watling and Peter Oster, and in this document, she specifically says that they found absolutely no coral in hydrographers. Now, if that's the case, hydrographer is in here. So much of this is, you know, the analogy, the association, and where's the data? Here's data right here by a coral scientist. And clearly, I don't know if it was not taken into consideration or what, but it's certainly a concern. I think that we need to look at these things more before we take a broad brush and we consider the management measures that can affect entire industries, which obviously this one can. And hypothetically speaking, I will say if there has been coral, if there has been coral identified, say, in Lydonia and Oceanographers, and it's there, and there's been fishing there for the past 30 or 40 years, and that coral still exists, I think what that's saying is they're probably coexisting fairly well. Furthermore, what I'd like to say also is that certainly in the lobster industry, our pressure, our fishing pressure is going down, if only because of our management measures. We're reducing traps. We've limited federal permit holders from possibly 3,000 plus to 139 participants in the offshore fishery, and we're reducing our gear, and right now we're looking to reduce it to about 50%, and who knows, it may be even more. So I think to say that when you're looking at all of this, you're painting broad brushes, you're looking at all of what can be done, the management measures which are not yet there but can certainly be there, and we're opening doors, we're setting the stage for management to be there. We don't know what the EFH is yet. We don't know what we'll be managing. I think there's a lot to think about and a lot to talk about before we just go ahead and adopt something. And finally, I'd like to just say I'm speaking for John Williams, who is the red crab fisherman. I think there's three of them out there. What he wanted me to just mention to you, he had to go to another meeting, is that they typically go from canyon to canyon to canyon. And he looked at these great big boxes that are being drawn, and he said what that's going to do in his fishery is take their boat and just go, for instance, from the Canadian border to that great big box that's around Oceanographers, Gilbert, and Lydonia, just go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and the pressure will be so great until they just kind of fish it out, then they'll just move over to the next place where they can fish before they hit another box. So that's his comment. I can't certainly go any further with that, but I would ask that you take a really close look at this. I don't think that it makes a lot of sense, and I certainly don't think that there's a lot of scientific data to support this. Thank you.
Okay, back to the council. We've debated this for a long time. David?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I mean, this debate about the EFH, there was EFH in there for monkfish and red crab and I think white hake, but I gotta go through the document and look. I mean, it wasn't done in a vacuum. And to Bonnie's comments, I couldn't, if she could come back for just a second, I don't know which canyon she said didn't have coral in it. I was trying to look at the maps. Hydrographer? Okay, I got to look through this and see if it's identified as one that does have it in it.
Pat, did you have your hand up?
Well, just
back. David, did you want?
They told me you said hydrographer.
Do you want to take, does anybody want to take a look at the article? If you want it, I can certainly send it down.
Okay. Well, what I'm saying is I think we have something here that says it does have coral in it. And if you look in document, for us it's document number 3, the draft supplemental impact statement, the one that has the boxes with the little marks for the various kinds of animals that are there.
Okay. I'll just send this down, take a look at it.
Just quickly, Mr. Chairman, because you're right, we have debated this for a really long time now. These things have come before us. I don't know how many times now, and these kinds of questions didn't come up. This is a habitat amendment, and this is our opportunity to consider coral and other structures. And there is, in fact, structure in these canyons that deserves protection, if in no other way than by designating it as HAPC. We can consider later what else might be necessary, if anything, but for the time being, there's vulnerable structures that like coral and other things, and we did get some direction from Congress that these are the kinds of things that we should be considering. In fact, the provision to allow us to consider the protection of deep-sea coral was put in a large part because of the discussions the New England Council had on monkfish. So...
Terry?
At the risk of opening the box again, thank you all for your good explanation of the value of deep-sea corals. I agree. But I have angst with a big box approach, and I'm going to make a motion to substitute. And my motion is going to be substitute options 3B, 3C, 3D, and 3I. For 3N and 3O. And that would give individual protection to each of the canyons that have been listed for all the good reasons that they should be protected, but eliminate the big box approach that we were just looking at in the Great South Channel area.
Is there a second? Jim Salisbury, second. Terry, your motion to substitute protects all the same canyons, but it takes the boxes away from, or it takes the groupings away from.
It takes a big box around the same canyons that will still be protected.
Okay.
Takes that away.
Yeah. Any further discussion? Jim Weinberg.
Yeah, I have a little different perspective. So you can go back to the discussion that you've been having after I'm done. But I've actually seen live, when I've been at sea, I've seen a lot of live video footage of the Great South Channel, hours of it. And also I've been down in submersibles off the coast. And when you go down in a submersible, you often only have a few hours of bottom time. So to characterize an entire canyon or something based on one or two dives, it's difficult. It doesn't necessarily mean that you've been to all the places where the species may exist. So that's something to keep in mind. One other thing, when you were debating the Great South Channel a lot and kind of tying that to juvenile cod or larval cod or something specific to a particular species, I was thinking the Great South Channel is really an important area for a lot of species. And so I was wondering if it's really necessary when you're talking about HAPCs to key them in on a particular species, or you can't identify it for a number of reasons and not a specific species. It's just something to consider. And I won't talk at length about why the Great South Channel could be important, but I could develop some arguments in general for why it can be important to a number of different fish.
Thanks, Jim. John Nelson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. You know, I think we all want to try to protect the three-dimensional structure as much as we can, whether it's hard corals or softer. And I think that the committee used the larger area approach because of the public comment that pointed out to us that there was evidence of three-dimensional structure many times on the top of the canyons and stretching between the canyons, and that if we ignored that we actually were missing the some of the various important areas. Now, you know, I understand, you know, from the folks that are, you know, fishing in the area and, you know, and feel like they're coexisting with the existing structure, and they probably are. They're probably being careful because they don't want to lose their gear. I suspect nobody wants to lose gear, and certainly at that depth. It doesn't mean that we're going to put something in to minimize, or I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that, to eliminate their efforts out there. It may be that we'll look at those and say that they're coexisting very nicely. That's not an issue. I think the issue that came about in the early discussions that the council had was that there was not trawling going on in those areas right now, and that was what, quite frankly, the corals were being looked at and the other three-dimensional structures as trying to protect them from future fisheries. Now, I hate to just pick on one type of gear, but I recall that was some of the comments that were provided to us, and that dealt with monkfish fishery and also the hakes, as David has already mentioned. And that's where central fish habitat takes place. Red crab trapping takes place. Apparently, from what we understand, there doesn't seem to be much impact from that. So certain types of gear may be what we would want to be protective of. And I think that based on the information we had provided to us, which is presence-absence, we're going back to the basic stuff. You know, it's not high tech here. It's going to be, hey, was there stuff there or not, and did you want to protect it or not? So that's what it came down to. We couldn't do a big refining and overlaying of this type of material. You're back to just the nitty-gritty, so let's recognize that. And if we want to take a larger approach to make sure we've been as comprehensive as possible and then narrow it down to the type of measures that we need to do to protect those, and I think that's what we should do. So, therefore, a long way of saying I don't think I'll support this motion. I'm going to support the original motion.
All right, we've had this discussion for quite some time. I'm going to call the question. On the motion to substitute, all those in favor, raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4. Opposed? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Motion fails. Back on the main motion. Anything else on the main motion? Okay. All those in favor of the main motion as amended, please raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 13 opposed. 1, 2, 3. Motion carries 13-3. Sally.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are two more committee motions. Page 6 of the decision document. The first of which is to approve the prey species evaluation included in the DSEIS for all species under management by the council.
Discussion on the motion. Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Any more discussion? All those in favor of the motion, please raise your hand. 14. Opposed? Abstentions? Motion carries. Sally?
The next motion, another committee motion, is to approve the non-fishing impacts evaluation included in the DSEIS for all species under management by the council.
Discussion on the motion. Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. I call the question. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Unanimous. Motion carries. Sally, anything else?
A couple more things. There's been some discussion today about the work that's soon to be completed in this phase one, the new EFH designations and the HAPC designations. We've also been talking about consultations that NMFS does with other agencies on projects that potentially impact EFH. The original intent of with the omnibus habitat amendment was to do it in two parts, as we've been talking about, and to submit it as one package in the end. There's been some informal discussion. I just wanted to get it on the table here. I don't know if it's something we can resolve today. Probably not. I think some more discussion needs to be had on the value of submitting phase one so that the new EFH designations and the new HAPC designations are in place, especially for use for EFH consultations. So, for example, the next document that I wanted to just go over briefly is a letter that went from the council to the Army Corps of Engineers about a beach replenishment project out on Nantucket. Right now, and until the habitat amendment is complete, we'd be using the old EFH designations and the old HAPC designations for that consultation. We've just gone through this three-year process, and so the thought was, why don't we get these on the books sooner rather than later so that the consultations can be using the best, the newest EFH designations and HAPC designations. There's some concern about that. I just wanted to get it out on the table. I'm not suggesting a motion on this right now. I don't want to do this on the fly, but I wanted to get it out there in the hopes that perhaps on Thursday, under other business, if it's something that people want to consider, that we might submit phase one so that we can get the new EFH designations on the books.
Jim Salisbury.
I think we've gone specifically out to the public with the stated fact that we were going to do phase one, we were going to do phase two, and then we were going to bring phase one and phase two back for wrapping together an approval and submission at that time. I think it would be pretty difficult to say, well, okay, but now we finished phase one, that's going to be implemented as or put in for approval, and then we'll go on to phase two. That's what we stated. That's what we went with. I think we are sort of stuck with it, whether we like it or not. And I think it would be very difficult, and it would make phase two probably even more contentious, that if you didn't think that you could correct something by put it when you put the whole package together, that you'd make them actually fit and work together, then it would be counterproductive to our goals. So that's just my sense of it, for if anybody cares. Thanks.
Anything else, Sally?
Under the tab 7, there were two other documents, the letter that I just referenced regarding the Sconset Beach Nourishment Project. I just wanted to highlight that for people so that they knew that the council had commented on that. It's a project that's in the works. It had gotten a lot of press over the last couple of months. And a letter went from Paul Howard to the Army Corps of Engineers. It's a potentially fairly major project. I'm not going to go into the details. There's a very easy-to-read mercifully short letter that highlights some of the concerns that were raised about that. The last item that was behind tab 7 was a presentation that the committee received from Mike Fogarty at the last meeting, and that was on the work that he's been doing at the Science Center on defining ecoregions within New England. And we had a pretty extensive discussion about this, and there were a few things that Mike is going to get back to the committee on, but just as we go into the discussion, especially about groundfish and thinking about multi-species management and how we can better manage a complex like groundfish, I think that some of the ideas that Mike presented are going to be worthy of consideration in the greater context than just, you know, the small realm where we've been talking about it in the Habitat Committee. We had a lot of discussion there. Mike's going to come back with some more information, response to questions that we had about the analysis that he had and how the areas are being defined. But I just wanted to highlight that so that when it comes around again, people aren't surprised. And with that, that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Anything else for Habitat? Okay. We're going to need to go in to do the sector portion of this agenda. I'm aware that there's a reception down the road. However, the chairman can't be here at the meeting tomorrow to do the sector report, and staff wouldn't be here either unless we didn't attend to it. So I'm going to recommend that we move forward and tackle the sector omnibus section of the agenda. Does anyone want to take a five-minute break before we do that? Yes? Okay. Five-minute bathroom break. Fine.